I always hate interrupting these great conversations because there's so much good that's happening in this room. But as I promised, we want to stay on time today because we have a brilliant individual that we're going to hear as much as we can from today. And I'm going to ask a friend in a minute to come up and introduce Jens. Before I do that, I want to acknowledge so many of you are in this room often, and we appreciate that. This is the room where it happens. This is where so much happens, and it's because of who's here. And I mentioned the sponsors, and we deeply appreciate the sponsors. We also appreciate all you who are taking time out of your day to be here to have these very important discussions. So I'm going to mention a few folks so y'all get a taste of who's in the room, and this is helpful to Jens also to understand who his audience is and who this conversation will be with. Alderman Brian Hopkins is here. He came over from City Council after a vote on an issue we talked about yesterday. So thank you, Alderman Hopkins, for being here. Inspector General Deb Witzberg is here right next to Alderman Hopkins. Thank you, Deb, for your work. Dwayne Deskins is here, always wheels turning with great questions, so hopefully we can get to Dwayne. April Greer is here. She's the principal of my children's school, so she's sitting next to me today. Miss April, thank you for being here and for all that you do. David is not here yet. Let's see. Candace Lenti is here. I mentioned Mike Lafrano. Tawa Mitchell is here. Always doing great work. Blue Pacheco, Cornejo, Travis Raymond and the Golden Institute. These are all folks that are changing the landscape of our city in various ways. These are business, philanthropy. I mentioned the McCormick Foundation and your whole team. Paula Waters is on her way from the Archdiocese. Joel Holberg is here. He's running for mayor. There's people here doing, there's business, there's politics. This is the intersection of all of that. And we are here as City Club. We take our role so seriously we have fun with it, but we do take it very seriously and appreciate that we share this platform with all of you who are doing these amazing things. We're just the convener. So thank you for taking the time. I also, there are only so many days in the year, right, and so many lunches we can have. We've had, this is our fifth of the year, so we've been busy. But there are only so many topics we can tackle, and one of them that we often talk about is gun violence. And maybe we can say it's helped. Maybe we can say things have gotten a little bit better. It's obviously never enough. All too often, I find myself up here the day after a tragedy, and it's every day. But it's some days it's more obvious than others. You know, we've got friends in Minneapolis that we're thinking about. I was up here the day after Charlie Kirk was assassinated, and there was a school shooting, and I thought about my kids, dropping them off with Miss April every day. That thank God for your smiling face to just welcome them. This touches every one of us every day. And, you know, we talk about these other cities. I remember being up here October 7th, or not understanding what was happening in Israel. And the room gets really quiet like it just did right now. And there's one, like it's one common denominator, and that's guns, and there are too many of them. And no matter how many times we come and talk about it, no matter how many partnerships we have, no matter how much work Rosanna Ander does in the crime labs and the education lab, there's always going to be this problem, and hopefully we can do just a little bit more to make it a little bit better. So I mean that from my heart and from, you know, on behalf of the City Club and the the civic community of Chicago. This is something that we're going to keep on. And today we're going to hear from this brilliant man, Jens Ludwig, who I've asked our friend, I mentioned Rosanna, for many years. She and I and others in this room, she's been hard at work, especially on the issue of violence and crime and guns in Chicago. She's tireless, fearless. She's a wonderful leader at the University of Chicago Crime Labs, the founder of that, in fact, national expert, and a great friend of ours. So please, if you would, I asked City Club to welcome Rosanna Ander to the stage to introduce our speaker. Thank you, Rosanna. Thank you.
Full disclosure.
I asked her to do that. Yeah, go ahead.
I was
going to
say, full disclosure, he called me about 45 minutes ago when I was in the dentist's chair. I agreed to do it because anything Dan asks for, I'm going to say yes to. Before I introduce my incredible colleague, Jens, I do want us to acknowledge it's Kim Smith's birthday. We all know and love Kim, so happy birthday, Kim. And the only part of Jens's bio that I'm going to read is his actual title, because I should know it and I don't. Jens is the Edwin A. and Betty L. Bergman Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. So what you need to know about him is he's a brilliant economist who has poured his heart and soul into trying to have an impact on some of the most intractable challenges facing not just our home city, but our country and even other places across the world. I've known Jens for going on 30 years. We met when we were both in graduate school. We're literally the exact same age. And I think the side of Jens that many of you don't get to see, that those of us who work with him get to see, is his brain is bigger than anybody's I've ever met, but his heart is even bigger. When my family was going through some personal tragedies, he would show up with groceries on my doorstep and leave them for me, despite having all kinds of other things going on in his life. When a dear friend of ours, who has done his time and came out and has done incredible work, needed a letter of support to the governor for clemency, Jens wrote the most beautiful, I think, powerful letter I think I've ever seen. And it goes on and on and on. So we're going to get to hear about the work that our team is doing collectively to try to help our home city and the rest of the country make progress on gun violence. But I also want you to know how incredible Jens is as a human being and how much he has sacrificed to do this work and to make sure that every minute that he has is to try to make the world a better place. So I just want to welcome my colleague Jens Ludwig up. So.
Goodness, what an incredibly kind introduction. Thank you, Rosanna. Thank you all for being here rather than home with a cup of hot chocolate. This is really, for me, this is the sort of day that that makes me deeply appreciate living in Chicago. Snowy, slushy, with wind chill, feels like -4. You know, it makes you wonder, like, who are these people who would rather live in California, Texas, Florida? What idiots. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to talk you through some of the big picture of the public safety environment here in Chicago, which I think we can all appreciate is the problem that sits above. I was just talking to Phil Clement before this. Public safety really is the problem that sits above every other challenge that our city faces. I'm convinced about that. And I want to talk a little bit about what's been happening with the public safety environment in Chicago, what we can say about what's going on, what we can't say about what's going on, and what that implies for what we should be doing next. So let me start off with the good news for starters, okay? This is a graph that takes a very long historical view. This shows you the murder rate per capita, murder rate per 100,000 people for the city of Chicago going back to 1930. This is the most reliably measured crime that we have. That's one of the reasons why it is such a focal point for our attention, okay? And the good news that you can see in this graph is as you all know, the murder rate surged in 2020. The good news is that we have seen continuous declines in most of the murders in Chicago are committed with guns. As you all know, we've seen continuous improvements in public safety since the pandemic. Including this last year, we've seen a 2025 relative to 2024, 29% reduction in the murder rate. That's 171 fewer people killed in the city. That's 171 fewer parents who get called at 2 in the morning with a call that no parent should ever get. At the same time, I want to temper this good news as well. So here's a different sort of perspective on the same sort of trend. So the murder rate in Chicago, even after this 29% reduction, is about 15 per 100,000, okay? One sort of benchmark that we could use is last year, but here's a different sort of benchmark that we could use. If we go back to 1930, so here's today, here's the tail end of Prohibition in 1930, the murder rate is 13 per 100,000. Here's a conversation that no one has ever had in Chicago. Here's my dream for public safety in Chicago in the modern era. Let us get back to the good old days of Al Capone and Prohibition. Right? We have a lot of work left to do. Here's another perspective on this, right? This is murder rates per capita for rich cities around the world, including Chicago last year and Chicago this year. Even Chicago this year, after a 29% reduction, is off the charts compared to any other rich city in the world. I can tell you from spending a ton of time in the UK talking to the federal their version of the federal government there, if this was happening in London, this will be a national crisis. Okay. So it is. This is all to say it is premature to declare mission accomplished. Okay. So what can we say about why we're seeing these trends? What can we say about why we're seeing these trends? So let me just start off by spending a minute saying, like, here's the thing that social science is good at. It's very, very hard to understand what's going on in the world. Here's the thing that social science is good at, is once in a while we can find a little experiment out in nature that incrementally changes one candidate factor that might be relevant for crime, and we can isolate the effect of that one factor that's changing and relate that to crime. Here's what social science is not good at: understanding trends in really big social phenomena. Because everything is changing all at once. That turns out to be really, really hard for social science to be able to pinpoint. It is this specific thing that is driving down the trend when everything is changing, which is all to say, my expert judgment after spending a huge amount of time looking at the data, how do we understand what's happening right now? The honest answer is nobody really knows. And I would say anybody who asserts that they know too confidently is just full of it. Right? You just cannot fundamentally know. So intellectual humility is the backdrop for trying to make sense of what's going on and what we should be doing next. Okay. With that said, let me share some hypotheses for what might be going on, recognizing that these are hypotheses and fundamentally who really knows. Okay. So I think one potentially relevant clue about what is going on here comes from the fact that the changes that we see are so sweeping. Okay, and here's what I mean by that. So when you look at different types of violent crime in Chicago, murders are down, non-fatal shootings are down, carjackings are down, robberies are down, aggravated assaults, aggravated batteries, almost every type of violent crime across the board is down. All right, that's partial clue number one. Partial clue number two is what we are seeing, this amazingly helpful trend that we are seeing in Chicago right now, is not unique to Chicago, right? I gave a talk in the Pratt Public Library in Baltimore earlier this year. Like, they're running around saying, this is amazing. Baltimore is experiencing this. Our friend Chief Tracy is the chief of police in St. Louis. He's saying, we're seeing these amazing trends. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. They are seeing these amazing trends. City after city after city across the United States, they're also echoing a lot of what we're seeing here in the city of Chicago. And within the city of Chicago, when we look across neighborhoods, you can see reductions in shootings in the huge majority of neighborhoods and really big percentage reductions as well. Okay? I do want to add a little footnote to that, though. There are a few exceptions here, including, in particular, the downtown area. And as we all know, what happens downtown gets outsized visibility in terms of public attention. And so if you're asking yourself, how can it be that sometimes public perceptions of public safety are misaligned with what the data is telling us what's really going on citywide? I think that's one candidate explanation, right? There's a shooting outside the Chicago Theater on a weekend evening. There's a shooting by the Bean. That is on the front page of every newspaper in Chicago for sure, and many newspapers around the country as well. You don't see the huge reductions in the neighborhoods quite as much. Okay. So the reason that I think that's important, is it helps us rule out a bunch of candidate explanations. If we are seeing such sweeping changes in violence across almost every neighborhood in the city, across all sorts of cities, across all types of violent crime, we can start to rule out entire classes of explanations, right? Any candidate explanation that is crime type specific, we can rule out. There is a new interagency government task force worried about carjackings or whatever it is. That cannot be it, right? There is this amazing organization that is doing work in neighborhood X and neighborhood Y and neighborhood Z. That cannot be it either, right? The city of Chicago has adopted a whatever, or the federal government wants to say, like, we're responsible for what's going on in Chicago because we just sent whoever to patrol, whatever, right? None of those explanations fit the broader patterns that we're seeing, which are so sweeping. So we can eliminate a bunch of candidate explanations. I want to then offer, again, a hypothesis about what could be going on, recognizing that this might turn out not to be right. So I spend a lot of time reading what people are saying about what's driving crime. And here's some of the common, these are going to be very familiar to everybody in the room. Here's some of the sort of common explanations that I hear over and over again about what is going on. Success has 1,000 fathers or whatever the saying is, right? So it's like lots of people are saying it's the amazing work that community violence intervention groups are doing around the city, around the country. Lots of people say it's what the police are doing. Clearance rates in Chicago are up for homicides. They're aligning better with the local prosecutor. Schools now are getting more social supports and counselors to help kids. There are amazing social programs going around all over the city. The Archdiocese of Chicago is improving reading and math scores for kids in a bunch of low-income, high-violence neighborhoods. Like, all of those are plausible explanations. What is the relative importance of each of those? I have no idea. You have no idea. Nobody can possibly have any idea. But the thing that I want to point out is there is a connection between each of these candidate explanations, which is that each of these explanations for what's going on takes money. All right? You put more money in and you get more social good out on the other side. That's the high-level feature of each of these candidate explanations, which means that there is a shared thing that sits upstream of each of these, which is the huge infusion that the federal government has made into pandemic relief funding for cities and states all over the country over the last 5 years. Okay. So I don't know, but that is a hypothesis. I think there are lots of ways to, like, there are lots of productive things that you can do to reduce crime. Right? Cities are spending money on lots of different things, but that's okay because there are lots of different things that can be helpful. There's been a big money infusion from the federal government. Maybe that is the thing that ties a lot of these candidate explanations together. Here's why I think that is important for us in early 2026 in Chicago and every American city, because we have been standing, as you all know much better than I do, we in Chicago have been standing on the edge of a fiscal cliff for a long time. Okay. And for the last 5 years, there has been one thing that has propped this up. That is the federal government infusion of lots and lots of money. And as you all know, that is now going away. So here we are on this fiscal cliff. That goes away. Guess where we go? This is why, this is a big reason, not the only reason why, but this is an important reason why not just Chicago, but every city around the country is wrestling with different versions of exactly the same sort of budget challenges that we have in Chicago now. Okay. So you might say, would more money, do we need more money to help address the public safety problem? For sure that would be super valuable. The problem is I am looking, or you are all watching the same coverage of the budget discussions that I am. Where is that new money going to come from? Now, you might say, well, maybe philanthropy can step in and fill the gap. I just want to calibrate your sense of scale here. It is easy to forget how ginormous the public sector is. That's an economics term, ginormous, by the way. That's how ginormous the public sector is. So many of you in the room will be familiar with the amazing work of the Partnership for Safe and Peaceful Communities here in Chicago. Amazing collection of local foundations that is doing God's work, raising money and putting that into things that are helpful in addressing public safety. They're raising my best estimate is they're roughly raising and giving out $35 million a year. That's incredible from the perspective of the generosity of the Chicago philanthropic community writing checks. But As amazing as that is literally a drop in the bucket compared to the 1,740 million dollar budget of the Chicago Police Department and the $10 billion a year budget for the Chicago Public Schools. So I worry that if we think that we are going to spend our way out of this problem, we are going to be sorely disappointed, because I think to the extent to which we can raise additional money at the city level, the most we're going to be able to do realistically is essentially the equivalent of finding like change in the sofa cushions. Unfortunately, I wish that this were not so. I wish that this were not so, but I really live my life waking up every day imagining if I were the, God help any city that would ever make me mayor. But if I were the mayor and I had no money, like what would I do? It's a genuinely super difficult problem. And I think at heart, there is really only one thing that we can do. Different versions of this one thing, but at heart, really only one thing that we can realistically do. And that is figuring out how to get more public safety benefit per dollar that we're currently spending. We are not going to have the cavalry come in and drop a bunch of more money on the city. If we want to fix this problem, that we have no choice but to do that. Okay. Now, you might be thinking, surely there's no way that this problem has been really difficult to solve even when we've been resource flush. So how in the world can we get more public safety benefit without additional money? And I have a new book out that that argues that that is possible. And here's what I think is kind of the mindset shift where you can start to see why that's possible. Okay. So I think for 100 years, the conventional wisdom about gun violence in America, about violent crime more generally, the conventional wisdom on the left has been that people engage in gun violence because of economic desperation, right? They're looking at their alternatives to crime. They feel like they have no choice but to engage in crime to feed themselves and their families, and the only solution is to make the alternatives to crime more lucrative to steer people away from that. People on the right, the conventional wisdom is crime and violence are driven by people who are just not afraid of whatever the criminal justice system is going to do with them. So the only solution is to threaten people with bigger sticks. And notice, as much as the left and the right disagree with one another, there is a shared assumption in those two conventional wisdoms, which is that before anybody pulls a trigger, they are engaging in some sort of like rational weighing of pros and cons. That is, the assumption has been that gun violence is a deliberate, rational, thought through, almost premeditated sort of behavior. So the only thing that you can do is change carrots and sticks. And it turns out that in a country of 330 million people, to change the fundamental incentives for human behavior takes a lot of money. That's why we've thought you can only change this problem with huge infusions of money. That is not what most gun violence in America is. Most gun violence is garden variety arguments that escalate and end in tragedy because someone's got a gun. I think the idea here was really perfectly encapsulated for me when we were visiting the juvenile detention center here in Chicago, out on Roosevelt Road on the west side. This is where the highest risk kids, according to the juvenile court system, are held awaiting trial or awaiting adjudication, whatever the jargony term for that is. And the staff member, he turns to us and says, 20% of the kids in here are psychopaths. You let them out, they're going to hurt other people. You have to keep them locked up. But he said, this is him saying this, and he says, but the other 80%, I always tell them, if I could give you back just 10 minutes of your lives, none of you would be here. Okay? Those 10-minute windows, think about yourself the last time you engaged in some road rage-like behavior. The last thing that you are thinking about in that moment is incentives, right? So I think what we need is essentially more interruption rather than big changes in fundamental incentives. Or at least that could go, that's not all we need, but that could go a really long way towards solving the problem. And the good news is that we can generate more interruption much more easily than we can change the fundamental incentives for human behavior in society. Okay. So I think that if the problem is people's behavior, normal people making a decision that they regret in a 10-minute window, there are two ways in principle that we can sort of interrupt those behaviors. I just want to illustrate a couple examples and then I'll stop. And then I think we're going to have a time for questions and conversation. But just to close this out, I think there are two ways that I want to illustrate. Again, this is not the only way to solve the gun violence problem, but I want to illustrate some things that we could be doing more of that would be really low cost and I think make a big difference. We can help people better self-interrupt in the 10-minute windows or even avoid getting into those 10-minute windows themselves, or we can increase the chances that somebody else is out there to step in and interrupt those 10-minute windows when they happen. Okay, so let me start with self-interruption, teaching people self-interruption for starters. So, you know, as some of you may know, our very first, the very first project that we did, the Crime Lab, was with our wonderful partners at Youth Guidance, the Becoming a Man program. I see Tony and Michelle and all of our other friends at Youth Guidance here. And, you know, what I think of Becoming a Man as doing is, in part, it's, you know, it's not just helping people de-escalate these 10-minute windows. It's almost like helping people pre-escalate, if I can. I don't know if that's a word, but let me coin that term. It's like, you know, I'm in the cafeteria and someone rolls their eyes, and all of us have a tendency to, like, you know, a friend of mine once told me, like, all of us in our minds, our whole life is a one-person play, and we're the star of the show. So I'm in the cafeteria. I see someone roll their eyes. I'm like, what is that motherfucker thinking about me? And one way that we can prevent conflict from happening is, guess what? There are 200 other people in the cafeteria. What makes you think that this eye roll has anything to do with you? That kind of thing. This is like a bastardized version of the amazing work that programs like Becoming a Man do, but you sort of get the high-level idea. So why is this relevant? So a few years ago, a federal judge took over. This is a picture of the juvenile detention center. A federal judge takes over the juvenile detention center because it's been a terrible place for a long time. He wants to make this place better for kids, better for public safety. He doesn't have any money, so he's looking around at opportunities to get more public safety per dollar spent. And he says, look, I can see the kids go to the Nancy B. Jefferson Public School in the morning, and then in the afternoon they go to the common room, and the kids sit there watching TV all afternoon while the detention guard stands against the wall watching the kids watch TV. And Earl Dunlop, the guy who was running the facility at the time, says, I think we can do something even more developmentally productive for kids than 6 hours of The Simpsons. So he trains the guards to do something that was not Becoming a Man, but it was in spirit kind of BAM-like. And the key thing about that is it is basically free. You've got the guards, you've got the kids, you've got the building. This is not like gold-plated BAM-type programming, but in a world in which you don't have any money, let's see if this does some good, right? So we worked with Earl Dunlap to study this, and we found, again, these are the highest risk kids, according to the juvenile justice system, when we saw a 20% reduction in recidivism rates. Now, you might say, I don't know how impressed to be with a 20% reduction. Let me point out, this is free. Give me five things like this that each reduce recidivism by kids at highest risk for violence by 20%. I think we're really onto something. Right. And here's the other reason. So I think the larger idea, this is not just the juvenile detention center. Every detention facility in the state could be, and I think should be doing stuff like this, because it is free. It is absolutely free. Why in the world are we not doing this? And I think the reason that I think this has the potential to have outsized impact is because it is essentially self-targeting. Right? When you look at the Chicago Police Department data on the shooters and on the victims, the overwhelming majority of both groups have prior arrest records. Here's what that means. They were in our collective care. Almost everybody who will go on to be involved in gun violence in the next year or two, we have a chance to do something more developmentally productive for them, and we can do that at super low cost. And we blew it. We didn't do that. And the way we know that we blew it is because they show up at a shooting scene, right? Let me just also point out that this is also, this is my high school, Lenape High School in Medford, New Jersey. The state of New Jersey, in their infinite wisdom, made me take 4 years of health class. where I learned super valuable things like I should be eating more broccoli, I should be avoiding alcohol, I should sleep 8 hours a night, and here's where babies come from. And yet, when you look at this, when you look at the public health statistics, here are the leading causes of death to American adolescents: homicide, especially in low-income minority communities, suicide, car crashes, drug overdose. The real challenge to American adolescents is not that they're not eating enough broccoli. I'm sure they should be eating more broccoli. That is not the real challenge. These are deaths of decision-making. Why are we not also using, if detention guards can teach this sort of stuff productively, how in the world can health teachers not teach this stuff productively as well? Okay, so super low cost, just by repurposing low opportunity cost time that existing institutions working with lots of people could do. Okay, so we have been in a mindset of spending more money to get more social good. We need to shift that to getting more social good per dollar of spending. One way to do that is to think, like, again, if we had more money, that would be great. Let's spend more on social programs. If we don't have the more money, let's think of cheaper ways to deliver more effective social programs to the kids who would benefit most from that. Okay. One more example. Let me just give you one more example of this. Another example of how we've been in a more spend more to get more social good mindset, which is let's hire more cops. Let's hire more CVI workers to, again, that'd be amazing if we could do it. We don't have the money for that. A different approach, a complementary approach that we could be thinking about is enlisting everybody in the city of Chicago, all of us, to help diffuse these conflicts as well, right? So 60 years ago, so the reason this is important, almost all murders in Chicago happen out in public places. And who is out in public? At any given point in time, if we're lucky, we've got a few thousand Chicago cops, even fewer CVI workers. In contrast, we have 2.7 million of us. Why can't we enlist more of all of us to help interrupt these 10-minute windows? So this was one of the key insights, I think, of many of you will be familiar with the amazing urban planner Jane Jacobs. 60 years ago, wrote a great book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. She was looking around saying, she's living in West Village at the time in Manhattan. She says, I'm looking around similarly poor neighborhoods in New York, and they vary enormously in their rate of crime and violence. What in the world is going on? Jane Jacobs hypothesizes maybe what's going on is some neighborhoods are more vibrant than others in terms of more people out in public, available and willing to step in and serve the public good, including defusing things when trouble is brewing. Right? And in the 60 years since then, we have seen an accumulating body of social science evidence that shows that Jane Jacobs is right. Anything that gets more people out in public turns out to reduce violence. Open a new store in a neighborhood, more foot traffic, violence goes down. Clean up a vacant lot, turn it into a pocket park. More people out in public, violence goes down. Improve street lighting, more people out in public, violence goes down. Clean up abandoned houses, you get the idea. Okay, and I also want to point out that the magnitudes here, the size of these changes, are surprisingly big, right? I clean up a vacant lot. There's great evidence from Philadelphia. I clean up a vacant lot. Shootings on that block in low-income neighborhoods go down by 30%. 30%! Clean up some vacant lots. Start infusing these sort of BAM-like programs in every detention facility. You are stacking helpful free thing on top of helpful free thing. Okay, now, what do we have to notice what we have to do to get this sort of stuff, right? I know there are a bunch of business people in the audience. I don't think I'm going to have to work very hard to convince the business people in the room that it is not always super easy to get things done in the city of Chicago. You're allowed to laugh when I say that, right? And many of you will be also familiar that there is a huge national conversation underway, the abundance agenda. Like, how do we change what government is doing in order to make government a help to rather than a hindrance for doing all sorts of stuff, cleaning up vacant lots, opening new stores? The abundance agenda started because these New York Times and Atlantic guys got pissed off and outraged that San Francisco spent $1.5 million and took 10 years to build a public bathroom. That's great that we're going to fix that. But here's where I think we would really need an abundance agenda on the south and west sides of Chicago. And I know that there is an effort like that underway with the Cut the Tape initiative in Chicago. I think few people would realize how transformationally useful that could be if we could get even more traction behind that for the public safety problem. Right. Very few people think that that is in any way relevant for public safety. And I think the data is suggesting it is surprisingly relevant for public safety. Let me just close with one final observation here, which is, let me go back to the graph where I started, the murder rate per capita in Chicago. And I just want to make one more observation about that, and then I'll close, which is, just let your eye gaze along this trend from 1930 to 2025. Okay. And I think what you will very quickly see is the one constant pattern that you see in this trend line is change. Right? The one constant pattern that you see is change. Especially when you look over the last 10 years. It certainly looks like over the last decade, we are seeing a huge increase in volatility in the public safety environment. We can have a conversation about why that is, but you can see that big drops are just as likely to be followed by huge increases as by continued drops. I say this because there will be the temptation to hope to assume that the encouraging trend that we had over this last year will inevitably continue. And I just want to remind us, it is not inevitable that this encouraging trend will continue. And the smart money would say it's at least as likely to rebound as it is to continue. And so I think the hope that all of us would have for our home city is, let us not, like, hope is not a plan. Hope that this will continue is not a plan. In a super resource-constrained environment, let us take that budget constraint seriously. Let us really think and work hard to change the things that we can change, even though we don't have enough money, we don't have more money, and really try and solve this problem once and for all. Thank you very much.
Let me just... Here, and okay. Yep. Thank you so much, Jens. Sure, this is working. Some incredible insights. We have a very informed audience here, and some great questions. You've touched on much of what they're asking, but I think we want to get a little bit deeper. Perfect. If you're good with that. And I'm going to start with, we do have our Alderman Brian Hopkins, and he's also the chair of the Public Safety Committee, mm-hmm. So he's very dialed in here. And he has a specific question about CVIs. I'm going to just read it. From text here, are there any other cities that stand out with best practice models for performance evaluation and compliance audits for publicly funded NGOs in community violence interruption?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I can tell you every one of the cities. You know, I gave a talk at the Philadelphia Public Library. There's a lot of conversation about the growing city investments in CVI there. In Baltimore, there's a lot of talk about how they can solve these problems as well. We will connect with you after the event. Chico Tillman is here, is one of the leading national experts on CVI. We can talk to you more about the best practices that other cities have developed. Super, super important point to make sure, very consistent, I think, with the spirit of the talk. How do we make sure that every dollar invested in CVI is getting us as much public safety benefit as possible? Thank you.
You touched on a few things that we can do. As I mentioned earlier, everyone here is—they're here for a reason. They're doing their part one way or another. A couple people specifically, and April Greer, as I mentioned, principal of Old St. Mary's School here in the South Loop, and also Paula Waters, who is with the Archdiocese of Chicago. So you can probably imagine they're asking where they can help, where churches, how can faith-based institutions in Chicago collaborate with city agencies and CPD and outreach groups to expand positive youth and family-centered activities, especially grounded in Catholic social teaching and broader social lens. How can churches, how can the schools and the churches really step in?
Yeah, my focus, I think the implicit focus of the talk is like 2026. You know, how do we make sure that 2026 looks like a continuation of 2025 rather than looking like 2020? And there's another sort of lens on this, which is how do we solve the problem over the very long term? And I think, you know, I didn't talk about this in the talk, but I think there is amazingly good evidence to suggest that one of the most important things that we can do to keep people away from violence, both as victims and offenders, is get them a high school diploma. Now, obviously, we'd want to get them ideally even more than a high school diploma as well. College degree, some sort of vocational certification, whatever. But if we can get people at least through a high school degree, there's really good evidence that shows that that is super helpful in protecting them from spending time in prison for committing violence or being the victim at a crime scene. And so I think there's tons of things that obviously schools are on the front line of that. And, you know, you can see in the data that there's huge variability across schools and across school systems and their ability to produce high school diplomas per dollar spent. So anything we can do to get the schools better. And I think there's also really good evidence to show that anything that we can do to support kids even before the first day that they show, like, you know, my University of Chicago colleague Jim Heckman has been banging the drum for the last 10 or 20 years about the huge importance of early childhood education. You know, you can see in the data that there's huge variation across kids according to their family socioeconomic status and their neighborhood environments in terms of their readiness for school on day one of kindergarten or whatever you would look at. Anything that organizations can do to help solve that problem, I think, would also be... It feels very counterintuitive. Like, how can it matter to, you know... How can school readiness in kindergarten have anything to do with a crime problem that's disproportionately driven by 18 to 35-year-olds? And I think if you just sort of think of the logic of schooling, it's like, sorry, I'll just take 30 seconds to talk through the logic here. It's like, you know, the eighth grade teacher, or let's say the third grade teacher in a school, their job is to teach third grade content. So they walk into the classroom, they've got 25 or 30 kids. Their job is, here's the third grade curriculum, teach that. And so in a world in which every kid is operating at the third grade, like, that's super easy. That's, I don't want to say it's free money for teachers, but it's like a very reasonable thing that you can do if everybody is at grade level. But now imagine that you're a kid who shows up in kindergarten already behind. The kindergarten teacher, their job is to teach kindergarten content. So the kid who's already behind is not really connecting with that. They start to fall behind. They wind up in first grade. Now there's an even bigger mismatch between the content that's being taught and where they are and so on and so on. And so over, you can see in the data, like, we have a ton of eighth graders here in Chicago who are effectively fifth graders academically, fourth graders academically, third graders academically. Imagine that you are an eighth grade kid operating academically at the third grade level. Who would not be pissed and turned off and disengaged in that circumstance? So I think, like, that is the in some sense, that is the public safety, that is the long-term public safety problem hiding in plain sight in Chicago right now.
Yeah, and talking about funding, I mean, we talk a lot about that here with regards to education and lack of it. In 2026, it's probably not going to be all that much better. So work to be done there. I have a bunch of questions. Dwayne Deskins is always brilliant. I'm going to have to read this. Basically, I think he's saying, with all the money in the world, why should, if we're trending down, so many, all right, although far higher than peer cities of L.A. and New York, Chicago's homicides and non-fatal shootings, violent crime are down to levels we haven't seen, like you mentioned. If local politicians all, you know, foundations, others, spend $200 million more to reduce violence in 2026. Shouldn't we determine why Chicago and most cities, big and small across the country, observe such consistent year-over-year reductions in violence before we spend a huge amount of money to achieve things that may be achievable without it or with far less? If the sun sets everywhere, why do Chicagoans have to pay for it?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is... you know, should we spend $200 million more on public safety in Chicago in 2026 is purely a hypothetical academic question to ask. Unless somebody here has $200 million that they're going to fork over for this. You know, I think...
Anybody? Show hands.
Any takers?
Okay.
Right? I think... I think the spirit of Dwayne's question is very consistent with, I think, what I'm arguing for here is, there are ways of getting more public safety from the money that we're already spending. That, even if we, let me put it differently. Even if somebody were going to drop $200 million into public safety in Chicago, which would be amazing if they did, why wouldn't you want to get even more public safety out of that $200 million plus the $2 billion that we spend on the Chicago Police Department and so on?
Mm-hmm. And just worth noting, the mm-hmm. business community and others really have stepped up and continue
for sure.
to,
yeah.
and we're proud of that in Chicago.
Yeah.
Again,
and we should,
more to be done.
Just to say also, like how grateful I personally feel to the friend many of us had, Jim Crown, for helping marshal that originally.
He said on this stage, and yes, and there are others that are stepping in. No one's ever going to replace Jim Crown. But, absolutely. Okay, I got six more. 10 minutes. Let's go to new approaches. Carter Stewart from Impact for Equity. Should nonprofits double down on existing strategies to reduce gun violence, or does the current environment require new approaches? If new approaches, what are they?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's obviously, like, nonprofits are doing, there's an enormous range of nonprofits. We're a huge city. There's an enormous range of nonprofits. Lots of nonprofits are doing lots of different things. And I think, you know, to the extent to which there is a potential room for shift here, I think, you know, one of the things that I see when I go around talking to people about the gun violence problem is the super understandable intuition that if we could change people's economic circumstances, we would change their risk of gun violence involvement. Now, obviously, it's super important and valuable to change people's economic circumstances so they're not living in material deprivation. Like, let's solve the poverty problem because poverty is really bad. But I think all of the data suggests that solving the poverty problem is not the thing. It does not get us a secondary bonus of also solving the gun violence problem. So if you are in the poverty reduction business, keep doing what you're doing. But if you are in the violence prevention business, I think shifting resources from things like job training programs, transitional jobs, that sort of stuff, if your goal is really about violence reduction, I think there are big, big benefits for shifting in the direction of BAM-like things. Not just, I mean, there's BAM, there's Choose to Change, there's Ready, there's a bunch of, like, programs that have the same sort of underlying active ingredient of helping people sort of recognize these 10-minute windows and avoid them or calm them down when they happen. Like, that to me, I think, is the thing that shows the highest return per dollar spent. And that would be the thing that I would encourage more and more nonprofits to take super seriously.
And thanks for mentioning BAM, especially Youth Guidance. They show up here at City Club and are an important part, After School Matters. These are some programs that didn't exist years ago that now we can point to. Every life, just like every gun taken off the street does matter. Every kid, every life, every instance is helpful. So we've got some great groups here. Back to CVI. This is from Mary Cruz Gallardo from the Brinson Foundation. Does CVI work when people develop internal tools to hit their pause button, or when it prepares more people to intervene when a person with access to a gun becomes distressed? Have you changed your mind about the cognitive or social mechanisms in CVI?
Yeah, if I understand the question, it's like, is it A or is it B? And I would say the answer is yes.
this is, by the way, why I answer or why I read some of these word for word, because,
people are far smarter than I.
So.
So I think, you know, one of the, this is just repeating what I mentioned in the talk. I think one of the things that CVI organizations do that is insanely valuable is, like, work with people before these 10-minute windows, work with people to anticipate your reactions, anticipate your unhelpful reactions, which we all engage in heated moments, and, like, to help you have a better chance in those 10-minute windows. And another thing that they do is they recognize that often we are not, my book is filled with embarrassing stories of me in these 10-minute windows. So if you want to know how badly a University of Chicago professor can act, you should read the book and be astonished. So we know that we are not always our best selves in these 10-minute windows. And there are huge value, especially when guns are involved, there's huge value in having violence interrupters around who are able then to step in and save themselves from themselves, right? Because, like, you commit a shooting in the city of Chicago, like, somebody winds up dead, but you have not helped your own life prospects in that moment either, right? And so I think that sort of interruption can save two lives, not just one.
Can you get into, you've talked about some best practices with other cities, but how about technology? There's a specific question here from Gregory Schaefer. There are questions about systems such as Evolve. Is Evolve an accurate weapons detection system? And it doesn't have to be just about Evolve, but there's so much happening with technology. We've talked so much about people and interrupting and personal interaction.
Yeah.
How about technology?
Great question. So here's my personal hypothesis for where the low-hanging fruit is to get more public safety benefit from technology is I think not just Chicago, but I think most cities around the country. So we have Ken Corey here from former NYPD is helping us with a bunch of our policing work around the country, and he can talk much more about this than I can. But I think my sense is that most cities around the country are not doing nearly enough or nearly as much as they could to use technology to capitalize on the fact that there's a lot of predictable structure about when and where these 10-minute windows happen in time and place. So let me just give you one concrete example. So this is something that I heard for a long time. And then as part of trying to understand the gun violence problem, I spent a bunch of time driving around with the Chicago police. And I was like, oh, now I get it. So let me just give you one concrete example. There is a liquor store on the south side, not very far from the University of Chicago, that closes at midnight. Most other liquor stores on the south side close 10 p.m., maybe 11 p.m. So up until 10 or 11, everybody is going to their local liquor store, seeing all the people they went to high school with, buying their booze, whatever. 10 or 11 comes, people want more booze. Now you get people from all over the South Side converging on this one spot, right? And now I am in line in this liquor store at 11:30 p.m., and, like, there you are, from this rival high school. And 3 years ago, you said this horrible thing to my sister when my high school was playing your high school in football. And now there you are right in front of me in line. And the liquor store knows exactly what's going on because I've been inside the lobby of this liquor store. It is all bulletproof glass. And to buy your booze, you put money in the little bulletproof Lazy Susan. They take the money and they swivel this around and there's your six pack of whatever, right? And what's really interesting about this liquor store is they are we've looked at the data. So Javier at the crime lab has helped me look at the data. They are not a gun violence hotspot when you look around the 24 hours cycle of the day. But when you narrow the lens to 10 p.m. to midnight, you see they jump out as a place at elevated risk. No human intelligence analyst at the Chicago Police Department, no matter how smart and diligent and thoughtful and whatever, they are not going to be able to see that needle in a haystack with their naked eye. But with the data, you can see that. Now, part of the issue there is just realizing the technology can be helpful, but the other part of it is really committing to using it. Because I think, again, Ken can speak to this much, much better than I can, but my sense is the really hard part for most police departments is making sure that their people are paying attention to this and monitoring that and holding people accountable. Like, that sort of, you know, very sort of basic organizational management kind of thing is where so many police departments fall down. The good news is you can fix that for free as well. Hmm. Like, the technology is really cheap, and fixing your organization is just a matter of, like, we really recognize this is important and we got to do it. And the size of the impact that you can see in the data when police departments figure this out can be really, really big. So that, I think, is another kind of first order thing. And I know that Superintendent Snelling really has this as a priority, but anything that we all could collectively do to support those efforts, I think, would be a huge win.
Great, and we're going to have Superintendent Snelling back. He was here talking about some of that recently, and he's doing great work, and we'll hope to have him back here soon and So many of these questions I didn't get to. We respect everybody's time. You're all doing great things. So my last question will be, will you come back? My favorite City Club question.
If you guys will come back, I'll come back. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for your efforts. Thanks for your research. Thanks for getting out there, driving around, and understanding this and helping us all better understand this. There's so much work to be done. We're doing some more here at City Club. We're going to gather you all for a whole host of programs in the coming weeks. So if you're not coming, check the QR code or on the way out or our website. Keep showing up and keep stepping up. And there's work to be done. And we're committed to doing more of it here. Thank you. Thank you, Rosanna. Thank you, Foundations. Thank you all for what you're doing. Thank you, Jens Ludwig, for all that you've done and shared with us at City Club.
Thanks.
Have a great day.